Hey, Mac, when does deer season start?
Well, if you want the best deer herd possible, Lanny, you need to start right now.
Right now.
That's why we're starting our promotion. I mean, we've got a Deer Season Starts Now promotion on plantbiologic.com where you can pick up our Game Changer soybeans, our forage soybeans, and our spring protein peas. While you're there, you might as well go ahead and pick up some brassicas like our final forage and winter bowls.
Yeah, stock up for the cool season planting right now. Listeners to the GK Podcast, if you use coupon code GKPOD, you can save an additional 10% off our entire selection of warm season, cool season, and clover food plot seed. Get started today and visit plantbiologic.com for an unforgettable fall.
I am Jeff Foxworthy, and welcome to Gamekeeper Podcast. If you want to learn more about farming for wildlife and habitat management, then buddy, you are in the right place. Join the Gamekeeper crew direct from Mossy Oak Land Enhancement Studio as they discuss the latest wildlife and habitat management practices, news, and of course, hunting. There's no telling what you'll learn, but I'm going to tell you, I bet it's interesting. Enjoy.
We are live in 3, 2, 1.
Well, thank you again, Richie, for a great countdown. Got us started here.
And boy, he's really proud of himself today. Richie.
We try. We try.
So, guys, it's turkey season. There's a lot going on.
Yeah, it's we've kind of come over the hump in turkey season. We're past the middle of the season here for Mississippi.
It's been a long one so far.
It has.
And it's still got a ways to go.
And I will say there's only, one turkey on this table.
You said it, I didn't.
Yeah, well.
And it's not me, and it's not Dudley.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I had a really interesting hunt over the weekend and killed a real unique turkey that had black wings and pretty good rope, pretty good
soft gobbler.
And he kind of had to think about what was going on with him. But he didn't weigh but about 15 pounds.
That's interesting.
He's a specimen. Some of his wing feathers are purely white and purely black.
There's no white on them, Lanny. They're black.
Okay. I thought one of them was white.
No, they're black. There's no white on them.
They're all black?
They're all black.
Well, not one of them's white.
No.
Are any of them barred like normal
yeah,
feathers?
Yeah, a couple of them are. Couple but of the them majority are. Of them are just solid black.
Good.
Well, I don't know where you got
I never let the truth get in the way of a good story.
That's well, Bobby, I think I'll surprise you now, but I cut all of them off the other day, and I'm going to make some fletchings for your for bow season
nice.
For you.
Yeah, thank you, Dudley.
I hope that excites you.
Yeah, well, I was going to donate that to the Smithsonian. They were talking to me about the uniqueness of that. But
it is a special turkey.
It was a lot of fun. You mentioned he was a soft gobbler, but I don't know if it was because he was out in a clear cut or he was over a kind of a little rise, but I thought he was a lot further away than he was. So, but Lanny thinks he was just a soft gobbler. But
I'm running into these this year.
Yeah, he has. I don't know. I think Lanny and I hadn't sat together this year, so I can't verify or validate anything he says.
Lanny, I'm curious why you're not on the board yet. What's going on?
I'm trying to get the monkey off of my child's back is the best way to put it.
Okay.
So it's for good reasons.
And that can be hard sometimes.
Oh, yeah, and it can be hard. It can. But I'm not on the board. I have not hunted solo really but one time.
Okay.
Well,
I hadn't really hunted much. I think I've done 5 sits.
Yeah.
I've just been playing at my new farm, and I've been seeing turkeys out there.
Ain't nothing wrong with that. Well, I heard
I've been making fire lanes, and I don't know, just for some reason, I hadn't been that mad at them this year.
To Brooks Tinsley the other day, and he said, you shouldn't have to worry about the turkeys out there anymore.
Oh, because he killed them all?
Yeah.
Yeah, he said it's a pretty good spot.
Yeah,
he said it was a real good spot.
Well, guys, so let's turn our attention from us.
We're shifting gears today.
And our insecurities, too. We're going to talk about deer today. And I met a guy. I've heard about this company a long time and heard great things. But our guest today is Mr. Doug Roberts. And he's from Michigan. He's been around big white-tailed deer basically all his life. He's got a company up there that makes this. It's called Conquest Sense, Lanny.
Mm-hmm.
And you've probably seen, there's one called Evercom.
Evercom, very familiar with.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Doug, welcome.
Glad to be with you guys. Thanks for having me on.
Doug, let me ask you that. You're a guy from Michigan. You've been around big deer all your life. Yeah. Can you tell us what you remember about the Mitch Rompala buck?
We're going there. I love it.
There's a lot of young people that might be listening to this that may not have never heard about
it. I fully remember this. Bobby, you and I were working together even back then.
Yeah, there's a photo of
there that. Is the Rompala buck.
I remember it.
Man.
I was young, but I remember it.
Mitch is a very unique hunter. He's probably one of the hardest hunters, and I don't know him personally real well. I know I have very close friends that know him very well. Denny Gehrink is one of them that has been a writer forever. That buck was living on a couple pieces of property next to the Traverse City Airport. And I do know that when Mitch would go out hunting, people were trying to figure out where he was hunting numerous times. And he would literally have to go and walk through a woods, have somebody pick him up, take him to another spot, walk through another woods, have another person pick him up, just so he could get rid of people trying to figure out where he was hunting.
Golly. Oh,
that is crazy.
Yeah.
Oh, it was.
It sounds like just, Bobby during turkey season.
it's really absurd, but Mitch is also a very private person. He loves hunting. That's all he loves to do. And he gets into it. But what most people don't realize is that his neighbor that hunted the property next to him actually had film footage of that buck on his video cam. And they were both actually hunting it. And Mitch was lucky enough to shoot that. But I remember Denny Gehrink called me and says, "Hey, I'm going to get to go and do an article on with Mitch on the Rompala buck." He's agreed to do an article. And that is when the people that were overseeing the Hansen buck, actually went to him and says, either put the buck up to be scored or sign off of it, because they were sitting there going, are we going to keep going and making our money or are we not? They literally had gone on long enough. They pushed him. And when they made that push for him just to step up and put it up, he goes, "I'm done.
Yeah,
I don't care. It's my buck. I'm out." And he shut everything down, and that was the last you heard of it. He signed off of never putting it up as a world record.
So, I don't blame you.
Well, what's your take on it?
Well, here's the simple part of it. If that deer was in the deer farming industry, like some people claimed, that was $1 million deer.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, that was unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
That typical frame is what everybody was trying to grow in our industry. And at that time, I was so involved in the industry and the breeding and the movement of deer, I would have known it, and a number of us would have known about that deer. And Mitch doesn't have $1 million to go buy it. I promise you that. There is no way that deer came from the deer farming industry. And then when I heard and then saw the video that his neighbor had of it, and his neighbor actually told us there was either a son or a brother that he felt was bigger.
November 13th, 1998, Mitch Rompala kills this deer, and it grosses 220 6/8, nets 216 5/8. So it beats the Milo Hansen buck, if all that holds true, beats him by over 3 inches. Or around 3 inches. It's a heck of a deer. But there was all this controversy about, look at how the antlers kind of lay down.
Everybody talked about the ears for some reason, which is interesting.
So you're saying that he was just such a private guy that he didn't want all the attention, and when they pushed him, he said, "I'm out."
Yeah. He has shot numerous big bucks. I mean, numerous. And most people never even heard of it, knew of it. Yeah, he never wanted the glory or the fame.
That's not why he's doing it. Yeah, I get it.
But I remember when Milo Hansen shot the Hansen buck, I actually had a farm in North Battleford, Saskatchewan, which he's just north of there. So we literally had the chance to go up. I was up there at the farm when he shot that deer.
Hmm.
And Milo was the same way. I mean, we got up there and it's hanging in the barn. The barn door's not locked. I'm looking at this thing. I mean, I'm looking at this going, "Oh my gosh, this thing's huge." And I'm going, you realize what you shot is big deer. You know?
Yeah.
And then he didn't want the fame of it. because everyone made him the number one expert whitetail hunter. He goes, I'm a farmer. It got driven out to me. It was my turn to stand, and I happened to shoot it. Then he realized how much money he could make off it, and it changed his life. But he wasn't happy about it either. The fame and the fortune came with a price.
Very interesting.
Wow. Well, you know that on Facebook, there's a Mitch Rompala fan page. And I don't know why, but I follow it. I've just always found the story interesting. But every day, Doug, somebody posts something in there about the Rompala buck. is Mitch still alive and kicking and up there hunting?
As far as I know, he is. I had let that go. The last time I actually asked about him, I was with Denny Gurney, because Denny was from my hometown, Allendale. When I ran into him, I said, have you talked to him? He goes, no, not really. It just, everything kind of settled down and everything kind of went back to normal life.
did you get to see the antlers?
I did not. That is the one I did not. Yeah. I saw the handsome buck, and then I saw Milo years later here. He came to the show here in Davison, and I saw the replicas. At that time, he said the real set was still sitting in the vault at the bank.
Oh, yeah. That's
well, so, I mean, you've been looking at whitetail deer most of your entire life. And like you said earlier, you look at them all day. It's your livelihood. And based on, you know, what you told us earlier, you do believe it to be true. But, you know, the sagging ears. And then I've also heard people say, you know, maybe they broke his skull plate or something and made the antlers wider. I mean, you understand deer anatomy. Does that photo look normal to you?
The layout of the antlers is unique, but we have seen similar layouts like that in the farm deer industry every now and then. It's rare, but it does happen, where the antlers, instead of going up and out, just flat out go out and come around. So it doesn't look abnormal to me. The abnormal is just the sheer size of the set of antlers.
Yeah.
It just, truthfully, that's what it is.
It's 30 inches wide.
It's huge.
I believe it.
We tranquilize deer all the time. And when we tranquilize deer, and if you go to hold the antlers up, the ears do the same thing that one does. So what would be the difference between tranquilized or dead?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, so, yeah, it's... There's all kinds of speculation. It's easy to speculate, but I do know this. That didn't come from the farming industry, because I would have been right on the front of the line trying to buy that thing.
Lenny, I had to tell you, hunting with you, you've got your phone in your pocket. You're constantly checking on X.
Yep. Very valuable key features all in those things. It really is. From the compass mode to recent imagery, I mean, it really helps you understand where you are spatially, where you're headed, where a turkey is, where he was. It's a heck of a tool to use in the spring woods.
I didn't realize that they're updating these maps every couple of weeks.
Yeah, I'd have never known about that clear cut that you were hunting if I didn't have that recent imagery.
Well, you know, and you could share some waypoints with me.
I could share some points with you. You're exactly right.
I mean, it has that capability.
It does have that sharing capability, which is great. You know, you're wanting to show me where your goblin turkeys are.
Oh, man. You know, Onyx, it's a great app.
It's a great app.
So guys can go to onyxmaps.com/hunt and use code Mossy Oak to get 20% off.
There you go.
I'm a big fan of Onyx.
I am too.
So have y'all got some turkeys up there we could come and hunt and stuff?
Harassing your deer.
Our season opens actually this coming weekend. So we haven't even been open yet. But yeah, here on the farm, we've got a bunch of them around. Like I was saying earlier, we got one group of young ones, probably 35 in that group of gobblers. We know one big one that's got 12, 13 inch beard. If I get him, I'll probably end up mounting him. I haven't mounted an Eastern yet. So he's on my hit list. But my son-in-law gets first crack out there because I'll be gone this weekend.
That makes me know. How does a son-in-law get priority on something like that?
Well, that's what you were doing. You were scouting for your son-in-law.
That's what I was supposed to be doing.
That's what you were supposed to be
doing. He didn't show up, though.
Yeah. The turkey did, though.
Yeah.
He's trying to talk my youngest daughter in, which is his wife, to go with him, because he had let her shoot it. But she loves to turkey hunt, but she doesn't love getting up early.
Oh.
Yeah, that's a problem.
That's a problem.
I can sympathize with that a little bit, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, if she'll have one strut in front of her, gobble and drum and carry on, that'll cure all that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
For sure. Well, Doug, we're happy to have you here. And I ran into you at a show a few months back, and we got to spend a lot of time talking, and I enjoyed kind of picking your brain. I learned a lot, and I thought that what I thought would be really interesting is to hear your perspective. You're a guy that's been around a lot of big deer that have been grown, and just things that an average guy that's got a small property, whether he owns it or he leases it or he's in a club, mm-hmm. could things that they need to be paying attention to that could help with the health of their deer herd and ultimately increase some antler growth.
There definitely are some things that the average hunter can do to improve the quality, not only of antler growth, but the deer herd as a whole. First of all, they have to understand that a year-round feeding program or maintenance program is much more beneficial than a seasonal, which most hunters do it seasonally. Mm-hmm. They think about it when they're going to, just before they go out into the woods, they think about it while they're in the woods. And then when the holidays come, they shut it down. In understanding the deer and what they are, and their nutrition plane is very important. And most hunters don't understand that. We can get into that in a minute. But if they just put out vitamins and minerals all year long, that those deer can fill in what we call the gaps. There's deficiencies in all of us in our vitamins and our minerals at certain times of the year. Well, the same thing happened with the deer. But if they have accessibility to keep them all maxed out, that means their immune system is healthier. That means their gut system is going to be healthier, which means their digestive ability is going to be healthier. So you're automatically improving the deer as a whole, which means the does are going to end up with better fawns. The bucks are going to grow better antlers. Now, you still can't grow a 190-inch whitetail if the genetic potential of the bucks in that area is a 150. And hunters also have to understand that. But you can maximize what we call in our industry the antler genetic potential within that deer. And that's really what you're looking for. The other thing that we've talked, Bobby, was food plots. Year-round food plots, and then up by us, what's most important is the winter food source, the wintering grounds, because of the cold temperatures, the thermals, and then what availability do they have for food to get them through the winter and into that early spring, summer when things start growing again. If hunters can concentrate on those, they're going to improve their deer herd greatly, plus the antler growth.
Can you talk to us a little bit about how much nutrition a whitetail needs?
Well, again, you know, I think I spoke with you back then that I hired a kid up in Canada to watch a wild deer herd for 365 days, and he picked everything they were eating in the morning, afternoon, and evening that he could find, and we sent it to the lab, and we broke it down into everything. And what we found is up here, and again, I'm talking my area in Canada, is that the month of March and the month of August are what we call the transition months. And if you think about it, that's kind of when March is when spring starts to come in and things start to wake up and start to grow. And so they're going to get that nutritional plane and their digestive system starts to wake up as well from the winter. They go into a semi-dormant state in the winter, believe it or not. So they have less intake, but they're able to use it. And that's where they use their fat stores. So when they go from that, they're getting into the summer. What we found is a deer's digestive intake, maximum protein level, is like at 18.4%. Hmm. Again, that's with our farm deer. It could vary down where you're at a little bit from that. It could vary up. But what we found was a lot of farmers were feeding that 22 to 30% protein. And we found most of the money was going out the back end. Mm-hmm. It wasn't going into the system. And so that's how we were able to break it down by looking at this wild deer herd, see what they had available to them and see how they were using it and what the intake was. Then when you come to August, you come off that, we always feed 20% because we want to make sure they get enough of what they need, but not an excessive amount. Now we drop back down to that 16. Then in the winter, we go back down to 14, which means the protein level goes down, but the energy level comes up. Energy, we know, builds fat. So it's preparing them for the winter, and there's as their system is going to start shutting down and slowing down after that rut period.
So carving them up, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Yep. Makes sense.
What's a good example of carbohydrate? Would corn be a carbohydrate?
Yeah, corn would be. It's got a low soybeans? Protein level.
I remember it's been several years, but there was an article in the QDM magazine about the importance of carbs in the wintertime and how, you know, for years they had always been, you know, protein. And then that article, there was a study and they talked about how important carbs were, especially in the winter.
Yeah. I was going to bring up the kind of our rule of thumb is that we want our deer to have a consistent diet of 16% protein to reach their genetic potential. But we never talk about, you know, we talk about feeding them after the rut, but we never talk about the need for carbs. It's very interesting. Never thought about that.
So
fatten them up.
Acorns would be a carb, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure, big carb.
Yeah.
Big carb. Yeah. Yeah. Acorns are big in carb. But you also got to understand alfalfa. Dry forage in the winter is actually good for them for the rumen. And it keeps everything going. Hmm. Well, most people don't understand it, and it takes 25 to 28 days for a deer's digestive system to adapt to anything new and be able to grow the organisms in its stomach and intestines in order to digest and take that in.
Huh.
If you think about that, that's basically a month. So that's those transition months that their body is transitioning from their winter food sourcing slowly into the spring and summer food sources, and then slowly back out in August. So nature makes sense. Nature is perfect in how it was created.
Yes.
We as humans screw it up big time.
Amen. Yeah, we really don't understand it either.
Right.
No, we don't. But living where I live, I literally live in the middle of the farm. So I got deer around me. It's been 33 years, going on 34 years that all I do is look at deer 24/7. It's easy to do studies and really watch things carefully.
Well, I was going to mention something about his comment earlier. I know, Mississippi State and their, the deer lab in their deer pens, they did a study again several years ago. And they got deer from different areas. They got deer from the coastal plain. They got deer from the fertile Mississippi Delta and different areas and put them together and, put them on the same feed sources. And what they realized is that, a lot of these poor deer could reach that maximum potential if you gave them everything they needed. It may not be in that first generation, but after some time, so if the doe was healthy and then the baby was healthy and they pass that on, a lot of it has to do with what they eat. Mm-hmm. So that was an interesting point.
It's totally what they eat, but it's also the ability to take it in. I know, and here's what's unique is down you guys, it gets really, really dry and really, really hot. Your water sources are much more difficult for the deer to access sometimes. But what we found up here when we have droughts that the deer don't do well because it's the moisture level in what they eat or the ability to get water to get the digestibility intake of the nutrients in those plants. And that's what a lot of people don't understand either. So when you have a drought, it's very important that you create a water source that's easily accessible, or they can eat all they want, but they're not getting out of what they need as it's going through the system.
As a kid, I used to hunt where there was a lot of cattle, and I'd see whole corn in the cow poop laying there on the ground. So, in other words, that didn't digest.
Not at all.
Is that kind of what you're referring to?
Well, that's one thing. When you corn, soybeans, all of those things create, they have a natural covering on them as a protector to some extent, and it's hard for the microorganisms in their system to actually break that down or get through that and break it down. We do a pelleted formula for a number of reasons, but in that pelleted formula, we do cracked corn. The reason cracked corn is so important is because it's already broke. It has that open edge. that those organisms can attack, break down, digest, and take in the nutrients really, really quick. When it's in a solid form, it has to work much, much harder, and there's time to just go through the system so fast that it can't break it down. I hate to say it, but deer, cows, and all that, they really can take a mouthful and just swallow it down. Well, if they don't crack that kernel of corn, the digestibility breakdown of that is very, very low.
That is interesting. No,
makes sense.
Yeah.
So about, I was thinking, we often talk about palatability, you know, which is, I guess, how tasty I think the stuff is to deer. And then we talk about TDN, total digestible nutrients. So you're saying, which makes complete sense. I'm just kind of reiterating it. Cracked corn would have higher TDN than whole kernel corn.
Correct.
Gotcha.
Absolutely. Yep.
And I'm assuming if it is whole, a lot of it may get digested. It's just much less efficient, so it might take their body longer to process it. They have to cough it up and chew it and do all of that, whereas if it's already broken down, once it enters their digestive system, that would be a benefit, I assume.
You're absolutely right. Now, think about in the winter, again, up here, they're trying to conserve all of the absolute energy that they can. So the more time and energy they have to spend on breaking that food source down to get stuff out of it, they're burning fat stores. They're burning. And again, I'm talking the wild deer. The deer on the farm have a perfect world. Okay. I mean, they don't realize it, but they do. They have everything they need. There's absolutely very few stresses on them. They just have this wonderful lay around, be healthy, happy, and make babies and grow antler.
Right.
Happy
but
deer.
In the wild deer herd, it's completely different. They have to, if I'm eating this, how easy is it to get the nutrients I need out of it and save my fat stores so I can make it through the winter? And the worst part is actually late winter, early spring, when most deer starve to death because they've lost too much body weight and they can't gain it back in the winter when they need to. That's the tough part.
Yeah.
So around our office, Lanny keeps yogurt in the fridge because he's real big on his gut health.
Thank you, Dudley.
And I've noticed, like on the back of a bag of feed, you know, we got some feed in the warehouse back here. You can see if you look at the label, there are different types of bacteria added to some of the bags of feed. And also you mentioned how when you introduce a new plant for the year, you know, to a deer, it may take up to a month for their body to recognize it and start processing it properly. Can you go into a little bit more and please, in layman's terms, explain some of that process and, you know, maybe how folks can help their deer in that regard?
Yeah. You're actually talking about probiotics.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
That's what it really comes down to. And so what you're doing is, and we have it in our feed as well. We put that in there. So as they're getting the nutrients in the feed, if they're, something has killed off a lot of those organisms that digest the things down in their system, we're continually putting new live organisms into their system to boost that and help break things down faster, more efficiently, to get more nutrients into the system. Therefore, the more nutrients into the system, faster antlers grow, the better they grow. And what they're going to find is hunters have to realize it may not be more size that they get out of the antler, but it'll be the density of the antler, the weight of the antler. The heavier the antler, the healthier the deer is.
How about that?
Yeah.
Look at some of those that have real light, big set of antlers, but it's very lightweight.
Yeah.
We'll have other. I wish I could hand you this set that I got near me. It's a 3-year-old. It is so heavy. It's unbelievable. But it's the density. The deer was super heavy, you know, healthy. There's all types of probiotics out there now. They're being sold in all types of forms, in feed supplements. Absolutely beneficial to the deer.
See these people? When the clock strikes 5, it's not the end. It's just the beginning. They have to do these things. They have to do those things. Enter the all-new LS Tractor MT2 and MT2E, a relentless force of innovation. Redesigned with a new hood and cab built for comfort and visibility, with enhanced lifting capacity to get the job done. Making these people the ones everyone else calls those people. Visit your local LS Tractor dealer today.
Moultrie has pioneered the game management category. Today, Moultrie is one of the best-selling brands of feeders and seeders in the world, and they continue to innovate with new technology that gamekeepers will rely on. Moultrie products are always field-tested and designed for hunters by hunters, combining forward-thinking innovation with time-tested practicality. Moultrie, first in feeders since 1979. All right, so guys, Moultrie is offering our listeners a 15% site-wide discount at MoultrieFeeders.com. Use code MossyOak with a capital M, MossyOak, at MoultrieFeeders.com and get that 15% discount.
Would you say that, like, a hunter, say I go out and for the first time in the year, I go and fill my trough full of nothing but corn. Can you explain what that can do to the inside of a deer's gut and how it may can affect them, you know, for the rest of the season or whatever?
Well, first of all, if you're going to start feeding it at the beginning of the summer, like you guys are already hot down there, corn is a super hot energy food source. So what you end up doing is you end up burning the system up. And when we say burn the system up, it's such a hot food that it burns up and kills off the organisms that can digest all of the nutrition they're taking in. So what happens is there's nothing there to digest anything, and the deer starts feeding off its own body, and then it's just literally a slow starvation over a month or two.
My goodness.
Yeah.
Feeding straight corn in hot weather, it can be very detrimental to the deer. Now, here's the safety net. Most deer know that by nature and will limit the amount that they eat for the most part. But I promise you, there are certain deer that are just like kids. Corn is like candy, and they will keep eating it as long as it's there, even if it's harming them.
Oh, pork chop.
Yeah.
He liked it, didn't he?
Yeah, he put on a lot of weight. Could not have been working against him. Well, you know, that makes sense. And look, Doug, there's some guidelines Mississippi State has explained to us about feeding corn down here, because we worry about alpha toxin and some other issues. And we try not – so if you're running a spin feeder, so to speak, you know, we don't want the corn to lay there on the ground and get moisture. So we just say no more than they can eat in a day. Mm-hmm. I think Mississippi State says 2 days, but just want no more than they can eat in a day. And that would help, I would think, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't want any bad information to get out there, but that's not a lot of corn. And that probably would not lead to a problem.
No, but a covered trough where they have
there, a covered trough. Dudley, what are you doing with a trough?
I was just using
it's legal.
I was using that as an example.
Yeah.
Okay. What's
well, there's probably more covered trough feeders that I've seen than I have spin cast. So, and it is a legal way to do it here, 100%.
You just can't pour it on the ground.
You just can't pour it on the ground.
Yeah. So, takeaway, guys, y'all got to be careful with fish in the warmer months with corn for sure.
Very interesting.
And you need to make sure you follow your state regulations here. Mm-hmm. We don't want to get anybody in trouble, Doug. So what we recommend, you know, to our listeners is diversity on your property.
Yeah, 100%.
I think you would – you're nodding your head. You agree there. So, you know, we like to have a diverse array of – food plots and I like a supplemental feed opportunity. So, but you got to be diverse.
Yeah, no
and
doubt.
Good habitat. You got all that natural browse out there, you know, you can manage for.
I'd love to go something that you started with, Doug, and it was about vitamins and minerals. One of the most often discussed things that we talk about around here, how there's certain studies that have said that they don't provide any benefit. But it sounds like from your experience, I'd love to know your thoughts on that, which I kind of can tell from what you said when you started out that it's something that you use. But help us also understand, do you have a regimen just like you do with protein and carbs? Do you certain times of the year give certain more minerals and then go to salt, or is there a special mix that you have there?
We have our own mineral pack that we've created over just the different little studies we've done. The big one was the deer in Saskatchewan many years ago. That's the base that we started it off of. Here's what I can say about that is, if there was anything that hunters were going to choose, there would be two things that I would be most concerned about. That is giving them vitamins and minerals all year long and a fresh, clean water supply. Hmm. Those two things. And the reason I say the fresh water supply is it creates the digestibility intake. When your cells have the water and you have the water it needs, they are able to absorb. Now, salt, they're going to take that as it's needed. And they know what they need and they know what they're lacking. They're very in tune with their body. I always try to tell people, they're always asking, you know, well, what minerals do I use? Well, first of all, that's a personal thing, but I like the items that are out there that are in natural form, organically natural, because those are going to be the most highly digestible, broken down, take in products that are on the market.
So are you referring to like some of those mined salts, like the Himalayan type salts and such?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Those are the ones that I prefer, because anything that is in a natural form is going to be in the most natural digestibility intake form. We cannot recreate anything that I know of that can match that equally or better. Hmm. It's not that we can't come close, but I want the best. And the best really comes in natural forms. I think, Bobby, I talked to you about, you know, like iron is a simple one I always use. It comes in three forms. The simplest, cheapest form of buying iron is rust. Hmm. Metal that's rusted. And it does have a digestibility intake, but it's very, very low. So to feed that to a deer, they have to take a lot of it in to get a little bit of it out, where the highest level, which is the most expensive, I don't remember the name of it off the top of my head. It's in our formula. I do know this: for every mouthful, 68% of it is digestibility intake. Hmm. So they have to take less in, they get more out of it. In other words, it costs me more up front, but they don't need as much of it. So it literally saves me money on the back end. So feeding good quality minerals, literally, once they've caught up and filled all the gaps in, they're going to need less of it. And so it saves you money in the long run, but you get your deer herd set in place.
So it sounds like, and I understand your particular mineral you feed is proprietary to you. Can you give us a little, not, I don't want to know your formula, like, but if there's only four minerals you could make available to your whitetail herd, could you clue us in on that?
It's different up here because it's hard to say, because it depends on where you're at. Like Michigan, believe it or not, is completely deficient of selenium. So for us up here, selenium is a very, very, it would be definitely in one of the top four, but down where you guys are at, it wouldn't have anything to do. So it's really understanding where you are at and what natural minerals you already have there that the deer have access to, and then which ones don't.
So is this very site-specific?
That's just like with soil tests and agriculture, you know?
It's exactly the same thing. I will say that you want to be very careful with your heavy metals. But any nutritionist that you go to any co-op and you talk to a nutritionist that creates a cattle feed, a sheep feed, a horse feed, they have the knowledge of the area you're living in, of what those animals need and what the area is lacking or is abundant in. And they'll blend that and they'll create that right to your need.
Hmm. That's pretty interesting.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. Or you could buy a bio rock from.
Yeah, and get your salt and trace minerals for sure.
Yeah.
You know, my little selling point with these bio rocks is I had a salt lick that the deer had been going to for years. And I put a bio rock and I put a white salt block right next to it and put a camera on it.
They way prefer.
I couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
9 times out of 10, they would lick the Himalayan salt on the bio rock as opposed to just straight up NaCl.
Mm. Yeah.
So Doug, in keeping this discussion going, I wanted to ask, right now everybody's experiencing antlergenesis. I'm assuming all your bucks have shed and you're probably seeing some velvet buttons and maybe even a little more. But we still got deer down here that have antlers.
Found a shed in my driveway today.
Is that right?
Today. Sure did.
So it doesn't seem to me that this is very anecdotal, but I'd just like your opinion. It doesn't seem like we have as long of a growing season for our deer to grow antlers as you do up there. Or do y'all, after they shed, do they wait a little while? Know and start at the same time, I guess is what I'm trying to ask.
It's interesting. There are variations based on where you're at. Our deer shed normally on the farm. Again, I'll talk about the farm because they have the perfect nutrition plane and they're not underweight at all. They'll hold them till literally into March and then they'll drop them. Our last one just dropped like a week ago. It happened to be a yearling that held them that long. The breeder bucks, which were 2.5, they dropped theirs, would have been like the second week of March, I believe, the end of that. And let me finish your question. So ours, if the weather is cold, they will grow antler, but at a very, very slow rate. But as the temperatures start to go up and the daylight hours start to lengthen, they'll pick up that speed. Right now, I would say those breeder bucks, which are now turning 3, they probably have a good 2.5 inches of antler sticking out of their head. And they, like I said, they dropped the second week of March, I believe.
Wow.
Well, that's,
they're getting after
it. Yeah, they are. Wow.
Well, to us, that's kind of slow.
2 inches of horn down here is something serious.
but again, now they'll pick that speed up. What I found interesting years ago, I had a 2-year-old buck that held his antlers till the first week of June.
Hmm.
And I literally thought something was wrong. I thought he had accidentally somehow castrated himself. I didn't know what happened, but it was like, what is going on? And then all of a sudden one day I found it fallen off. And the very next day you could see new antler on his head. It was almost like the new antler pushed him off.
Hmm.
Our end of our growing season basically comes to the middle to the end of August. So let's just say the end of August. That buck outgrew every other 2-year-old on the farm and ended up being 209 inches.
Good grief.
It was, and he literally grew it. And I mean, everyone else has been growing for 1.5, 2 months, and he outgrew everybody. I really believe every deer, as long as it is healthy, gets the nutrition it needs, it's going to maximize whatever time frame you have. And I can compare it to Canada. I mean, you look at Canada and the growing period up there for those bucks is much shorter than what you guys have. I mean, their summer is very, very short, but it's packed with a ton of energy, a ton of protein. And so they just push it out. We did a study years ago on deer and elk because at that time we were velveting the elk and selling the velvet, of course, to Korea and so on. If we were measuring the amount of antler growth that they could do in a 24-hour period, on a hot, humid, hazy day, we had whitetails that were pushing 2.5 inches of antler a day.
Wow. What an amazing creature.
Oh, yeah.
So you could sit there and watch them grow if you were bored enough.
Yeah.
Well, here's what's interesting. The elk bulls were pushing just under 5 inches a day. And so when we went to cut them, we had to take the antler off at a certain specific point where they call it the heart of the 4th and 5th time. It had to create this perfect picture. You literally had to check them at 8 a.m. in the morning, check them at noon, and check them at 4 because they would outgrow the perfect cut.
Oh, wow.
That's how fast they were growing. Now, if it turned cold, it slows down. Now, why does that do that? It's the heart rate. The faster I can get that heart rate to beat, the faster it's pushing calcium up through that blood vessel and it's pushing out antler, because that's what it's creating from. So it was amazing how it worked.
Amazing animal.
It, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's the fastest growing tissue known to exist. Isn't that right?
It's not a cancerous tissue, but they say it's the fastest growing multiplying cells that they know of, and it has a memory of how to grow. It's just amazing.
Amazing animals, no doubt.
Yeah, and they're trying to figure out, you know, they're using antler for cancer and research studies, trying to figure out if they can figure out how it can do what it's doing, not being a cancerous cell. Can we take that same system and reverse it in cancer cells and shut cancer down?
Yeah.
And so it's been fun over the years. I've worked with University of Michigan on different things and projects with antler where they've been studying that and getting the antler to them. And
yeah, hopefully that could lead to something big.
Oh, no doubt about it.
So along those same lines, Doug, you had expressed to me that you had been working with a group that was doing some research into CWD, and y'all had identified some deer that may be resistant to CWD. Can you explain that to us, please?
So the deer farming industry, when CWD came up, we started looking at all of the different options or possibilities. First, it was, how do we test for CWD in a live animal? That was the first thing we looked at. And so the industry has literally come up with a rectal biopsy test, a tonsil test. We now have the RT quick test, which is an amplification test. We can take tissue, we can take urine, feces, and it can be amplified within a system, and it can identify it very quickly. But then we got Dr. Haley and Dr. Seabury involved. So Dr. Haley literally went into the genetic strain in a white-tailed deer and found 7 markers that he felt identified some level of resistance of catching CWD. Once we started to test some of the deer in the farming industry, he found that 5 of those held very, very true. GG is highly susceptible. S's we now know are the most resistant. You have K's, you have H's. So that was the first initial. And so some of us said, well, let's start breeding. Can we breed to start producing what he thinks is more resistant animals? Now, it doesn't mean they can't get CWD. What it means is if we put a SS deer in an environment that's contaminated, they can live in that environment and not get infected for a longer period of time than what a GG animal can. We now know that a GG animal in an infected environment will be infected within 6 months or less. So if I don't want to have an infection coming onto my farm, I don't want any GGs on my farm. Mm-hmm. I want everything but that. Now we bring in Dr. Seabury. Dr. Seabury was the one when scrapies was very rampant in sheep. They brought him in and he did the same thing. He looked at the genetic markers of all the deer. It's actually 251,000 markers of sheep. I'm sorry. And he identified them and was able to number them and go, okay, this one falls on this line and it's more susceptible than the other one. And so we're looking for negative numbers. Zero's in the middle. If you're to the right and a positive, the further right you go, the more susceptible the animal is to CWD or scrapies in sheep. In 15 years, by following his guidelines and breeding the ones that showed, you know, resistance, they eliminated scrapies in sheep. Literally in 15 years, scrapies did not exist just by following those markers. So we went to him and said, can you do the same thing with the white-tailed deer? He said, well, yeah, I can. Well, for us, he did it with 51,000 markers. We couldn't afford 251,000. So he did 51,000. But that's a lot more than 5.
Mm-hmm.
And so what his numerical scale has done has validated that the SSs seem to be the most resistant. And now that we're getting enough animals into the system, we're starting to realize that you can even have a GS, but they might have a negative number, which is the best resistance you can get. So we now want to go to the negative numbers to the left of zero and start pushing all of our animals that way. You have to understand, in the deer farming industry, most of the animals on most farms are either hunted, culled, harvested one way or the other, probably by the time they're 7 or 8 years old. So if we can get animals that have resistance for at least 7 to 10 years, we don't have to worry about CWD in the deer farming industry anymore. Mm-hmm. So it's exciting times. Our farm now, all the animals in our breeding program have the resistant markers in them at some level. And we're just continuing to push those numbers further to the left with higher negative numbers.
So when you're looking at introducing new deer into your farm, you just say, hey, I want to be sure that's an SS or an SG. And do you have a genetic test that proves that?
Yeah. So NADAR, which is North American Deer Registry, which was created a number of years ago, we not only do the parentage of all of our animals, but we also do the genetic testing for resistance to CWD. So every single animal on my farm is identifiable for generations back and also for resistance to CWD. Now, my farm is unique because we have the scent company. So we have had a closed herd for, I think, 17 years now. We've never brought a live deer in.
Gotcha.
And we won't do that. We can change our genetics through semen. We can purchase semen straws or embryos and actually bring that in and change the whole genetic structure of the farm.
Wow.
So, Doug, what you guys have figured out, how can that be applied to the wild deer herd? Do you see like a path or a direction that this could go and maybe branch off in and help the wild herd?
Well, I can, like Michigan right now, Michigan, the DNR has finally started to test the deer in the wild by county. And what we're trying to find out and see is, are there pockets of animals that have some level of resistance, and are there pockets of highly susceptible GG animals, we call them. Now, I will tell you this. We've already found out that the majority of deer up in Michigan are GG. Mm-hmm. They're highly susceptible. What we're also finding, though, is that they almost seem to be like in dogs. They almost seem to be like the mutt. They have a little bit of everything, so they're super strong. We're finding a lot of the SSs, the KSs, the HSs, the HKs, they're almost like a purebred where they may have a slight weakness in them, and they're a little more susceptible to something of dying. It's a hunch right now, but we're looking into it. But if we can find areas of resistance within the wild deer herd, would it not make sense to let that group multiply? In other words, don't do the doe takes. Let the does multiply as fast as you can. But if you find a susceptible area, cull more of them out of that area, create what we call the vacuum, and let the resistant ones move over into that area. A lot of people say it just isn't possible. I'm kind of optimistic. I think it can be. It's going to take much, much longer in the wild. Here's the other option is you start wiping out the GGs and you start taking some of the animals from the deer farm industry and planting them in the wild that we know have resistance and letting them breed, and you're going to breed resistance into it. Hmm. I can tell you that's not going to go over well with most agencies.
Right. But I look, it is a glimmer of hope in all the darkness.
Well, deer were originally stocked from somewhere.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm just kind of trying to.
We did our TV show when we had our TV show about the life of a family deer farm. We actually went back and traced back, how did deer farming start in Michigan? It was the DNR.
Nah.
There were so few deer in Michigan that they literally caught some of the fawns, took them to cattle, and it was actually dairy farmers they started with, and asked if they would bottle feed these, raise these, and then as they had babies, release the babies back into the wild. And that is literally how they restocked the state of Michigan with white-tailed deer. Hmm. And once they had enough, they went back to the farmer and said, hey, you know, thank you. We're done. We got enough deer. And they all went, oh, no, we really enjoy this. We're not going to stop doing this.
Right.
Oh, well, then I guess we'll give you a permit to keep raising them. That's how the deer farming industry started in Michigan.
Interesting.
And I think it is in most places, honestly.
That explanation, I'm not sure I understood all that, the SSs and the GGs, but the fact that people are, smart people are trying to figure this out.
Yeah.
And there's money being.
And there is some resistance because the way it's been built is this is completely catastrophic. You know what I mean?
And it makes a lot of sense. And I see parallels, and I know I mentioned this on the podcast a lot, but I see parallels in the plant world.
Sure.
You know, like with the chestnut blight, or and other things, you know. Yeah, so
there is,
and they
resistance.
Run into hurdles, and you know, you try to do it the quick way, with, you know, maybe changing the genetics and things like that in a test tube or in a lab, or you can let Mother Nature sort it out, or you can kind of come up with a hybrid of those two ideas, mm-hmm. you know. But it's just really fascinating to learn about that and to see how the private sector is taking this on. Compared to our DNRs and such.
Well, guys, we have to understand, and we have to give the DNR agencies a big break here. What most hunters and most people don't understand is their job is not to, they don't know how to fix disease issues or problems. They are a management agency that manages the wildlife and the habitat of our states. The group of people that are experts at eliminating and fixing disease problems is the Department of Agriculture or USDA or the ag departments in your state. That is what they're trained to do, and they have the resources to be able to do it. Again, we took Dr. Seaberry, you know, from the sheep industry and the scrapie world. He's working with the dairy and the beef industry in those areas. So we're asking an agency that doesn't have the capabilities or even the equipment or the labs to try to fix something that is bigger than what they can handle. They're trying to manage and keep the herd alive. Now, the good news is it's been around for 40-some years. It's never eliminated a single herd. So we know that it's not going to do that. We do know that there's certain resistance out there that's naturally there.
Is the USDA working on this?
Oh my gosh, yeah. They're actually, the last probably 6-7 years have really jumped on board. In fact, I know there was one herd that came down with CWD. They just live, it was a trace back to that herd, and they just live tested that entire herd out clean, that it did not have CWD in that area. And that's the first time that's been allowed and approved. They're literally, they have millions of dollars for our industry, the farming industry, to start testing all of our animals for these resistant levels. Because if we can go that direction, the farming industry doesn't have to worry about CWD. We're literally going to breed it out of existence. Again, it's hard to transfer it over, but hunters have to understand the DNR agencies, it's not their, they just don't have the capabilities. It's not that they don't want to fix it. They just don't have the capabilities sure. to do it.
Yeah, this is so interesting. And I mean, it just kind of reminds me that we all need to keep an open mind and not be so quick to judge or, you know, just decide this is right, that's wrong. You know, keep an open mind. I've really enjoyed hearing what you're having to say about all this. I've learned a ton. I hope we can keep learning here.
Well, it's exciting to, you know, I mean, we hear all the gloom and doom, but then I don't know, until I met him, I hadn't heard anybody say like, hey, look, this is, but we may have found
there's some light in the tunnel. That's exactly right.
I'm an eternal optimist.
That being said, since we're talking about a little bit of controversial issues, just a little bit, Doug, do you think the moon affects deer movement?
Absolutely, yes.
There it is. Thank you. Just wanted to ask that one out there, too. We've talked about minerals and CWD, but might as well ask about the money.
Yeah, we.
Yeah, it definitely has an effect on them. There's a pull. It's interesting when we watch the full moon in that month of May or the first part of June, it's amazing how many of the fawns will drop around that full moon compared to any other time. And we artificially inseminate a lot of our deer, so we control that drop period, and they'll still shift it 5 to 10 days one way or the other. And, you know, we also watch our bigger bucks, our older bucks, of when are they on their feet. And that moon overhead and underfoot has an actual impact on them of when they feel like getting up and moving.
No doubt about it.
Interesting.
Yeah,
it is. You rarely hear somebody say moon underfoot.
Yeah.
That's a unique term. There's a really good book.
I've heard of it. There's this guy. Good book. I don't know about a good. No, it's a great book, Moon Underfoot.
Oh, man.
The Furminator is the industry's most versatile piece of food plot equipment, allowing plotters to do every step of the process, working the soil, adding seed and soil supplements, and compacting. From start to finish, with a single implement, it's hassle-free by design. Set it for the seed size and simply drive the tractor, and the Furminator does the rest. Check it out at theferminator.com.
Hey guys, Dudley from Gamekeepers here. I want to tell you about the all-new Gunner Dog Bowl. It's designed for home and built for travel. It's customizable, leak-resistant, light on weight, solid on durability, and rust-proof. Like other Gunner products, they're made in Nashville and designed for everywhere.
Nosler is known for their bullets, and now they're making suppressors. Nosler suppressors are made for hunting. Adding a Nosler suppressor to your rifle will make you a quieter, more accurate, and more effective hunter. Protect your hearing and disturb less game with a Nosler suppressor. The time to hunt quiet is now. Learn more at Nosler.com.
I want to know more, you've seen folks like burying these big Tupperware containers and making little miniature ponds for their deer and going and filling them. Is that what you would recommend in an area that's really droughty in the summer? Okay.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
The Banks folks have a water system thing. I've seen it in our magazine a bunch and heard good things about that.
Well, I've never thought about it until Doug mentioned it in to relationship to digestion. You know, I just think hydration. I just didn't connect the two, but it makes all the sense in the world. Mm.
And so, would you say that would be better than like a farm pond or something, or just any available water?
Now, if you have fresh running water or you have a pond that continually has springs putting fresh water into it, yes. But as soon as you get to that swampy, stagnant water, there's so many bacteria. Okay, I'll get on my soapbox for a second.
All right, we want it.
Perfect.
First of all, never feed off the ground, ever. Because everywhere where you guys are at, where I'm at, there are bacteria in the ground that can be harmful or deadly to all animals, including white-tailed deer. The two most common are coccidia and giardia. I have watched coccidia get into a three-month-old fawn, perfectly fine, run around, and it is dead in 4 hours. It multiplies so fast, and it came from stagnant water, where the bacteria gets into the water from the mud and the dirt. So just for the health of the animals and the cleanliness, keep everything off the ground that you possibly can. Secondly, the fresher the water, the cleaner the water is, the better it is for them just to take in. I mean, it's like us. We're not going to eat or drink bad water because we're going to get something out of it. They can handle a lot more of the bacteria than we can, but it's still the same process.
Okay.
And clean
so
water.
It makes sense that it would stress their system more trying to deal with all that bad bacteria they took in, and it takes away from their body being efficient and processing what they're eating properly.
And think
you're stressing that immune system. If you're stressing the immune system, you're stressing the digestional system. Now the digestional tract, you're headed on a collision course of a major problem. So we try to eliminate all water. Now, in the spring, you just can't do it. We just got an inch and a half of rain in like 4 hours. Okay, everything's flooded and everything's washing through, and we drain everything very well. But like I just told the farm hands, I looked at all the breed pens. I said, I want to fill in all of the fence lines where they've been walking all winter because it's muddy. They've all had to be filled in before fawns come. Because that's where the fawns are going to go and lay. And as soon as they're going to start put babies, do what? Put everything in their mouth. That's how fawns are the same way. Only it's going to kill them. So,
well, and you know, down here, we've got, we never worry about water because there's water everywhere. But the majority of it is, especially in the summers,
can be stagnant.
And most of it is.
I would venture to say that most sources of water are not nearly as reliable as they were 200 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting.
So, right.
Got to put some
now, in. Understand, most adult deer systems can handle because generationally they've learned to adapt and handle that.
Yeah.
You're really looking at trying to save your young fawns and yearlings that don't have the immune system and digestive system developed enough that can handle it. So it's not like you're trying to save the adults as much as you're trying to save the young ones. The hunters have to understand that.
We got to figure out how to do those shallow water wells, Dudley.
Yeah, that'd be a fun project.
So, Doug, you know, and we're all the time talking about trying to, and we've kind of expanded this from 4 years of age to, boy, let's let him get to five. Or let's even let him get to six now. But it in y'all's industry, it seems like y'all's bucks, that second and third year when they have their biggest antlers. Can you explain that to me?
Yeah, so in our system, what we're finding is in the typical framework, when you're looking at typical whitetails, that three, sometimes four is normally their largest set of antlers. In the non-typical world, it seems to be that four and five, sometimes six. But the reason is, if let's go back to the wild deer herd. So if you have a perfectly balanced deer herd, you have the right number of does for the night, right number of bucks for the food source that they have, and you have mature bucks, the younger bucks, the two-year-olds, do not want to get into the breeding fight. They do not want to get into the rut because they know they cannot compete with those four, five, six-year-old bucks. And so what they do is they kind of hang around the outside. They eat all the time. They stay healthy. They keep their body weight up. Yes, they'll go and chase deer. They'll go and chase some does if they can. But as soon as one of the big bucks comes around, which he's always around, goes, well, your area, I'll back off. So come the next spring and summer, this buck's in perfect shape. This 2.5-year-old now turning three is in perfect shape. So what's he going to do with all of the food source? He's got the stress levels down. He can maximize the antler potential that he has in his system. And you'll find that, I found it, when you look at most of the record books and you go back through history in the Boone and Crockett, the majority of them, or a lot of them, are 3.5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Because at 3.5, their body and their system is saying, I have to get into the breeding system. I have to go fight. I have to go get my own territory. I have to start breeding does. I have to go compete with those 4 and 5 year olds. And now a lot of them are getting run down. They're getting injured if they don't get killed. And I'm taking my territory. So my body's run down. So now I got to build my body back up before I can start producing antler again at 4 years old. Therefore, I might get back to where I'm at, but most of them don't get back to where they're at. They're definitely not going to increase.
Literally, we really talk about, you know, we talk to Mark Drury and Lindsay's and these others, and these biggest deer they kill are like 5, 6, and 7 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And
or even 6 to 8.
Yeah. Yeah. I got to wrap my mind.
Bobby, you understand something too. They literally, their situation is unique compared to the average hunter.
Oh yeah.
They have very large pieces of property. They've managed it very well. They manage their doe herd. They literally have what I have here at the farm. They just didn't put a fence around it. That's not what the average hunter has availability to. I can let my bucks get up to 6, 7, 8 years old if I chose to keep them here. and they would probably would maintain at that point. But that's not the norm for most hunters that they're going to run into. I mean, I know the Drury brothers, the size of property, the Lee and Tiffany, I know their property. Those deer never leave their property because they have enough property and they have absolutely everything that that deer needs within the property in the middle. And the pressure of hunting is almost zero.
Yeah.
They hit their target animals. They go in, got it. I'm back out. And the rest of the deer don't even know really anything happened. Mm-hmm. That's not the norm for most people in hunting and how to manage their deer herd. And so for an average hunter to look at that 3.5-year-old that's a 155 and go, you know, I'm going to let it get to 4 because it's going to be a 165, or get it to 5 where it might get to 170. And the genetic potential is only 160 in the area, and the neighbor on all four sides is going to kill it at 3.5.
Yeah. Yeah. That's real world.
That is real world.
Yeah.
It does make sense what he was talking about his 3.5-year-old bucks, you know, not just in that certain age when they've got everything they need available to them, being able to express their genetic potential in relation to getting in the game, you know?
Yeah.
Cause our 8-month old bucks trying to get in the game around here.
So Doug, tell us about Conquest Sense.
Okay. So Conquest Sense actually has been around for 20 years. It's had three different names. Started out as Border Crossing Labs because I had farms in Canada. So it was Border Crossing International actually was the farm name. And then when I brought the Sense out, thought of the Sense, it was for laboratories, but everyone thought we were selling Labrador Retrievers. So we knew that name didn't work. So then we went to Border Crossing Sense, and that worked actually really well for a while. And then we realized actually the Bass Pro Shop, the buyer, I came to us and said, I can't carry your line of Sense because of your name. We're like, what are you talking about? He goes, down south, you can't say Border Crossing. That's not a good thing. We're in the north. You know, never even thought about it. And so we actually kind of went on a name search. Well, that year, we had a yearling buck that really grew well, and we had named him Conquest. Ended up being, as a yearling, he netted 172 inches typical.
Wow.
Still the largest yearling I've ever grown, typical-wise. Just one of those unique deer. And hence, ended up calling Conquest Sense. But really, what we're known for is, like you guys know, Evercomb. And also the wax stick formula. So how that came about was literally my farmhand and I, we had to run 90-some deer through the facility and vaccinate and medicate. And it was just two of us. It normally takes three. And he came to me first thing in the morning. He said, hey, you know, let's get this done. I want to go out hunting. It's, I don't know, it was the end of October. It was going to be a good night. It was right around Halloween time. And I said, well, let's get him run through. And of course, as time would have it, we started to run out of time. So by the time we got done, there was probably 35 minutes before dark. He was not happy with me. He just went into the office. He grabbed his bow, hopped on the four-wheeler, and he had his work clothes on. And I looked, I said, you're not going to get in your hunting gear. He said, doesn't matter. I'm out of time. I'm just going. Really, you're just going to get out of there just to get away from me, I think. And I looked at him. I said, you got diesel fuel? You got grease? Okay, you do you. I don't, you know, it doesn't matter to me. And I went up to the house. And about 15 minutes later, he calls me. And I'm thinking, oh, he fell out of the tree. Maybe he got lucky and shot one. You know, so I, hey, what's going on? He goes, you aren't going to believe this. I've got deer everywhere around me. I'm like, what are you talking about? You shoot one? He goes, no. He said, they'll go downwind of me and they'll stick their head in the air and they'll smell. And then they start chasing each other. And I said, well, how many do you have? He said, I got like 11 or 12. I said, Curtis, we've never had 11 or 12 deer back there ever. He goes, well, I got them right now. He says, I've stood up. I've sat down. I'm talking to you on the phone. He said, they're watching me. without even thinking, I just went, well, Curtis, you stink like a herd of deer. Because he had literally physically held on to every single one of them in the squeeze. So he had the hair, the sweat, the spit, the pee, the poop, everything that a deer could create. He had it on his body, covered in it. And it hit me like a ton of bricks. I went, oh, my gosh, the perfect scent for attracting and keeping deer feeling safe. It's just all the deer smells.
Smell like a herd of deer.
Yeah, makes sense. Well,
it came out as deer herd in liquid form. And then I thought of the wax thing. And then we came out with deer herd in a stick. And we gave it to a bunch of TV hosts and professional hunters and hired a marketing group. And he went around and talked to all of them. He came back. He said, there's only one word that they all said the same. And I'm like, yeah, what's that? He said, they all said it calmed the deer down. He says, you created a calming scent. You created a whole new category in the scent industry, and we're going to call it Evercalm. And we thought he was nuts. but we said, okay, let's do that. And that's how Evercalm was actually renamed and created.
Interesting story. Deer herd in a bottle.
Yeah. How about that? That's hard to replicate, I would imagine. You got to have a herd of deer to be able to.
So, what
do
you do? Go out there and comb them every day and sweep it up and
put it in a Vitamix.
Put it in a Vitamix, yeah.
Yeah. Everyone said I'm walking around behind them trying to catch it as they pee. But
a Flobie, is that what it is?
No, what most hunters, you know, we have a large room that is climate controlled that we can actually bring groups of deer in. It's basically a bedding area. There's the food, the water. They have everything in there. If it's 95 outside, it's 60 degrees in there. If it's 10 below zero, it's 60 degrees in there. It's very comfortable. In fact, the deer that we collect from actually like being in there because it's so comfortable. And then we collect everything from that bedding area down through a stainless steel drain system from underneath in the ground. And that way it's nice and cool. It's always ground temperature, no matter what time of the year. And then we go and take it to the manufacturing facility, strain it, and then manufacture it into the product. So it's what's also makes it different is, like, if we collect product on a Monday, we literally process it and pour it on a Wednesday. It is packaged into the bag on Thursday and Friday. There's not another company that literally collects that fresh, manufactures and packages it and seals it that quick. And it really is what makes it so effective because it is literally so fresh and the wax just holds it in a dormant state until you put it out and it evaporates before it can even start to go bad.
So do you put it on yourself or is it just something you open up when you're in the stand or you spray it on you or?
Evercalm in the stick formula, you can wipe it on anything. I wipe it on my boots. I wipe it on my pant legs, my arm sleeves. So as I'm going in, if I bump anything, I'm literally just leaving deer smells. I'm leaving a deer trail. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, every time we put it out, it's new deer in the area.
Well, I've heard a lot of good things about it, Doug. And I enjoyed meeting you. And we've enjoyed talking to you today.
It's been a pleasure. And it was sure fun talking to you at the show.
Yeah.
We're outside and twiddle our thumbs in our booth for a while.
Yeah.
They're like that sometimes.
I had a lot of questions for him.
I bet you did.
What about this? What about that?
We should have been recording then.
Was Mac with you?
No, Mac was going at it. He was at
Doug, you would
have.
Yeah.
But he did meet Mac.
He did meet Mac. Yeah. Good. So.
Well, guys, look, we've been so busy this week. Sheffield, I apologize. I didn't get a trivia question together. For Doug, but it's just it's been a busy week. It's turkey season, Doug. What do you? Don't look at me like that. We got a lot going on.
Maybe we'll do.
I
two
think
next
if you'd
time.
Asked him anything about deer, he would have nailed.
He would have known it.
Go ahead and give him the dinger over there. Yeah. He won.
I don't know about that. There's still a lot to learn about whitetails. I can tell you that. So.
Well, Doug, thank you. Guys can go and check out Conquest Scents. You can Google that and find Doug. I think on Facebook, Doug Roberts, the deer professor.
The deer professor in the house, yeah.
How about that?
Yeah. So, yeah, appreciate it, guys. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks, we've enjoyed the conversation, too, a whole lot. Hope to have you on again.
More than happy to be with you guys. It's easy.
Yeah, save some of those turkeys for us next spring.
We'll keep them away from your deer now.
Yeah, it sounds like you've got too many of them.
Yeah, that's a problem. But we got a special team just designed for that.
All right. Thank you, Doug.
I appreciate it.
All right, thank guys.
You. Thanks so much.
Lanny, what'd you learn?
Tons, you know. We always talk about science and applied science, and it seems like Doug is out there every day, literally living with a deer herd. So his observations are very interesting to me, really are. So
Yeah, I think I've already said it. You know, just keep an open mind. There's a lot of knowledge out there. Don't be so quick to make a decision. Yes, I'm specifically referring to the CWD, and I was just fascinated with all the gut health and yeah, everything else we talked
and
about.
And the minerals and the moon phase and all of it.
Yeah, what's interesting is they're watching, they're doing things and then watching how the deer react to
right
it. And, yeah, you know, I'm trying
in
to
in a controlled environment, which gives a huge advantage to be able to really figure out what's going on. Because even all the studies that we read are in the wild, and there's, you know, things that can't be controlled.
Yeah. You know, and at the end of the day, we all want to do it. We want to manage our habitat.
We want what's best.
Yeah. We do. And I think listening to what these what some other people have learned the hard way.
Yeah.
We can use that to help make us better, for
yep,
sure.
Absolutely.
I think my favorite thing was the water, for sure. It was just a complete eye-opener for me.
Why don't you say goodbye, Dudley?
Goodbye, Dudley.
Get us out of here, Richie.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of the Gamekeeper Podcast. And be sure to tune in again. Subscribe to Gamekeeper Farming for Wildlife magazine. And don't miss the Mossy Oak Properties Fistful of Dirt podcast with my good buddy, Ronnie Cuz Strickland.